We discovered that there were secrets that your body was trying to tell you that could really help you optimize performance. But no one could monitor those things. And that's when we set out to build the technology that we thought could really change the world.
Welcome to the Whoop Podcast. I'm your host, Will Ahmed, founder and CEO of Whoop, where we are on a mission to unlock human performance. At Whoop, we measure the body 24/7. And provide analytics to our members to help improve performance. This includes strain, recovery, and sleep. Our clients range from the best professional athletes in the world, to Navy SEALs, to fitness enthusiasts, to Fortune 500 CEOs and executives. The common thread among Whoop members is a passion to improve. What does it take to optimize performance for athletes, for humans, really anyone? We're launching a podcast to dig deeper. We'll interview experts and industry leaders across sports, data, technology, physiology, athletic achievement, you name it. My hope is that you'll leave these conversations with some new ideas and a greater passion for performance. With that in mind, I welcome you to the Whoop Podcast.
Sleep consistency is obviously really closely related to your circadian rhythm. And so if you have high sleep consistency, your body is able to anticipate sleep, which is why we're seeing sleep consistency explains as much as like a 3% difference in sleep efficiency. It explains this difference in slow wave sleep and REM sleep. And we think that that's because when your body's anticipating sleep, it knows what to do.
What's up, folks? In honor of World Sleep Day. That's right. Did you even know World Sleep Day is coming up? World Sleep Day on March 15th. This week's podcast is all about sleep. My guest is Whoop Director of Analytics, Emily Capitalupo. Actually, our first employee at Whoop, our first hire. Emily's part of the founding team. I've had the pleasure of working with her for 6 years. She's totally brilliant. She's a published author who specialized in sleep for nearly a decade. And at Harvard, she was one of the top researchers around sleep. Emily and I discuss her background and role at Whoop, how we became an industry leader in sleep monitoring, as well as several new features we've released this month to help you better understand and optimize your sleep. We crowdsourced questions from all different Whoop users, people of different backgrounds. This includes how to make your bedroom optimal, why Romans didn't sleep for 8 hours, how you can improve your sleep stages and get more REM and slow wave, how do you fall asleep faster, what products Emily uses to improve her sleep, and the truth about exercise before bed, the optimal strain to maximize your sleep. That's just some of what we talk about. This is an amazing, amazing podcast. I think you guys are going to get a lot of value out of it. Without further ado, here's Emily. Emily, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So we are going to talk about all things sleep. I am very excited about this. I think our listeners are very excited about this. Now, you and I met in 2013, I believe, and we've been building this business together since then. It's been quite a journey. Why not, for our audience, you just give a little bit of background on how well, you and I met, and also how you got so interested in sleep and physiology.
Sure. So when I was in high school, I was actually lucky enough to get an internship working for Andrew Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was studying neurodegenerative diseases, so like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And at that point, I sort of already knew that I was interested in neurobiology, and at the time, I thought sort of medicine. You know, I absolutely loved working for him. I think he's doing really cool work. But what I realized was that I really hated working with sick people. Like, I found it depressing. And so I kind of had this, like, weird thing where, like, I found human physiology fascinating, but sick people made me stressed. And so when I went to college, I got a job working with yeast. So I figured, you know, we were studying infectious disease. And I was pre-med at the time, and I thought, oh, I'll work on diseases, but I don't have to see sick people. You know, we're just working on growing these proteins in yeast, and yeast smell bad, and they're, like, really unpleasant to work with, and it just made me hate the smell of beer and bread and all these things. And so I was kind of like, I actually liked working with people, didn't like working with yeast, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I realized I just love sleeping, and I think it's fascinating. And it was like, oh, I wonder, do people study sleep? And And so I Googled it, and actually, like, one of the world's sort of leading sleep labs is at Harvard, where I was an undergrad at the time. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And I started looking into what they were doing. And I just sent, like, a cold email, and I was like, I love sleeping. Can I work for you? And Elizabeth Clareman was sort of nice enough to let me in, even though, you know, I was like a freshman and didn't really know too much.
This is when you were a freshman at Harvard.
Yeah, so I'd been working in this infectious disease lab for a couple months, and then I was just kind of, you know, this isn't for me. And so then I started working for her, and actually ended up, you know, working for her through all 4 years of school. I wrote my undergraduate thesis in her lab, and you know, we published papers together. And so, you know, I really discovered that, like, you know, sleep is this really cool kind of field where humans spend about a third of their lives asleep, and the sort of only universally agreed upon answer to, like, what the purpose of sleep is that otherwise we get sleepy. And I kind of thought that was so exciting and, like, interesting that, like, there's nothing else that you spend even close to that much time doing that you don't know the purpose of. And all these leaders in the field, they're just like, yeah, otherwise you get sleepy. And we know that after, you know, a week or so, and then the record's like 11 days, you die. So clearly something really important is happening when we sleep, and we know that we feel like crap if we don't. But sort of what its purpose is, you know, despite obviously, you know, hundreds of years of research and, there, you know, so much has been written on it, there's really, we don't know anything. And I thought that that was really exciting. I liked that, you know, sleep research is predominantly working with healthy people, and so none of our subjects depressed me.
Right.
So that was really good. And I thought it was super interesting. And, you know, it's really cool to do research on something that you experience. When you're working with sleep, you just sort of, you know, every night you're like, oh, what am I doing? And so there's something kind of cool there.
Well, I think that it's a great background. And for me, I had a lot of the same feelings, although admittedly I wasn't spending nearly as much time in the weeds as you were on sleep specifically. But just as a college athlete, I felt like, okay, you should know so much more about this recovery period mm-hmm. in order to understand how well you're training. And so those were like the very early days of Whoop. And you and I met at the Harvard Innovation Lab. Mm-hmm. And I remember you had like all these interesting job offers. And I was thinking to myself, like, wow, this woman knows so much about physiology and sleep and recovery. You know, how can we get her to be a part of the team? And so what got you excited at that point to join Whoop?
I mean, I think what got me excited about Whoop was really like the same thing that got me excited about sleep. It was this idea that, like, your pitch to me was, we all work out and we have no idea, like, if we're working out too hard, and, you know, we want to train as hard as is safe to. And I know you had, like, overtrained, which is the worst, right?
Yeah,
you work,
right.
Like, too hard.
Yeah, right.
At that point, you know, I'd completed all the pre-med requirements, but I really wasn't excited about med school. And I wanted some way to kind of marry that physiological background, all the academic research I had done, but to sort of do it in a setting where we could have really high impact. The summer before I joined Whoop, I had worked at a healthcare consulting company, you know, and I spent like all summer working on this, what I thought was a brilliant proposal for how we were going to increase follow-up appointment compliance for people who visited emergency rooms, which in the south side of Chicago happens to be like pathetically low. And, you know, it came up with this recommendation. They were like, great, in 6 months we'll review it and, you know, maybe we'll try some of these things. It just felt like you work so hard and there's no impact. And what I really loved about Whoop was that ability to, like, have, you know, really high impact and to sort of help people train now and to kind of, you know, unlock for them a lot of this information that's just sort of there for the taking and that no other product was helping bring forward to people's attention. So, like, you know, there are all these things, like, athletes have no idea how much sleep they need, and, you know, it's not that hard to kind of help educate them, and that it just seemed like there is so much low-hanging fruit, and so there's so much opportunity to make a really big difference.
Yeah, and your point about the process in academic research to get things done is a good one. I mean, it's like, I found it really slow. I found that the sense of urgency mm-hmm. around academia was lacking.
Yeah, and I did it for 4 years, and I loved it. And I mean, I did it in high school too, but I'm not counting that.
Right.
But it's really interesting. But it's like, I wrote this paper, and I was so proud of it, and I worked really hard, you know, and it went through the peer review process and it got published and, you know, it's been cited and, you know, all this other stuff's been built on it, but I can't really tell you, like, what's come of it. Like, obviously, not trying to hate on academic research. I think it's, you know, it's so important and, like, I love reading all those papers. But for me personally, I kind of liked, you know, with industry, that stuff actually sort of gets out there much faster and that there's, like, a little bit more of, like, a tolerance for trying things and just moving quickly.
Yeah, I think within weeks of, you know, working at Whoop, we were creating algorithms and scores. And in those early days, we knew we wanted to have pillars around strain and recovery and sleep. For those who are less familiar with Whoop, strain's like the intensity of a workout. Recovery is how prepared your body is for strain. Sleep is measuring things like the quality of sleep and how much sleep you need. And all of these things tie together in an ongoing coach. For you, like, you know, you read this paper that I put together. I was like, okay, these are the things I want to be able to talk to users about. How do you go from taking physiology, which is a science, to creating scores, which is part science, part art, really? Because there's no recovery metric out there that we're comparing our recovery metric to. We're trying to base it off of all the science that's out there.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a case-by-case basis, but I think, like, our big sort of what we're looking out for is not necessarily, you know, something like our recovery score, right? Because, like you said, it's like, you know, I can't go to the doctor, do a blood test and say, like, oh, this is your recovery. There's no objective standard. But what we can do is we can show that we're putting together metrics that are useful. And so, for example, we did this big study with the Corey Stringer Institute at the University of Connecticut, where we had 80 athletes wear Whoop for an entire year. And we looked at their recovery score every single morning. And then half the athletes were on the women's track and field team. The other half were on the men's soccer team. And we looked at, you know, every time they competed, you know, for obviously for track. So we were looking at their pace. For soccer, we were looking at things like shooting accuracy and turnovers and stuff like that. And what we found was that the recovery score predicted how they would perform that day better than sort of what other people were using at the time. So things like morning resting heart rate, even morning heart rate variability, how much sleep they had self-reported to get the night before, and also how much sleep Whoop had measured. And so what we were able to show was that our recovery score is a more useful predictor of how you will perform that day than anything else that was sort of commonly being used. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be improved upon in the future. It doesn't mean that, like, there maybe aren't, like, other things that could also be better than, you know, resting heart rate, HRV, or sleep alone. But we were able to kind of combine them in a unique way that had never been done before that created something more useful. So what we're always kind of looking for is, like, can we create something more useful than what people already have? And, like, that's our metric for something being, you know, sort of worth putting out there.
Yeah, and I think you gave a great background there. What we've always tried to do at Whoop is marry physiology with actionable insight, right?
Yeah, so one of the things that was kind of cool about the recovery score is that we wrote it before we'd ever collected any data.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not, you know, a traditional data science approach in that way. So we took all of the literature that we could get our hands on, a lot of stuff from Dr. Daniel Plews in New Zealand and Martin Bouchette and sort of their labs. And we looked at, you know, what is known about how resting heart rate in the morning correlates with performance later that day. What's known about HRV? How reliable are these as predictors? And what are the sort of pitfalls where maybe, you know, they can be misleading? And we tried to integrate them into a combined model that gave weight to, like, what the literature said we could rely on. And then we sort of, you know, came to the Corey Stringer Institute with, like, the literature seems to suggest that this model is useful. And, you know, at this point we'd all been, you know, kind of Whoop employees internally had been looking at their recovery scores every day. And so we had a sense that it sort of felt good, but we didn't know. And so sort of by doing this study, we were able to show that, you know, it in fact is combining these metrics in a useful way, and that, you know, we were getting something that was a better predictor than what was available. as opposed to, I'd say, like what a traditional data science approach would be to like collect all the data first and then retroactively fit a model. But we didn't have the luxury of doing that,
right?
Because we needed to create a score in order to sell a product that people would put on and collect data on. So there's a little bit of like a chicken and egg thing there.
Well, I've just been amazed by, you know, all that you've done to build these algorithms, and it's been so much fun building it with you, Emily. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on what you've built as a foundation for Whoop today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now we are going to get into questions from Whoop users. So we've surveyed our top 100 sleepers and learn things from them. And separately, we've crowdsourced questions from everyone who follows Whoop. This could be Whoop users. This could be people generally out there who want to better understand sleep and recovery. And now you are going to answer these questions, Emily. Okay. So let's start with surveying our top 100 sleepers. So these are the top 100 sleepers on Whoop. How'd you determine these people, first of all, Emily? And then what did we learn from their responses?
Sure. So we actually looked at a combination of their sleep performance, their sleep efficiency, and their sleep consistency over the past 90 days. And so we looked for users that had been on the system for a while and were sort of consistently hitting these top metrics. And then we broke it down a little bit. So we made sure that we got people from all different age groups.
And how wide of age groups do these 100 people fall into?
So I think our youngest top sleeper was 19, and then they went up to people in their 50s.
Okay.
And what I found the most fascinating that we learned from them is that they're actually not doing anything all that insane. Our big kind of motivation behind surveying these guys is that sometimes people will write into support like, oh, my sleep need is completely unrealistic. How does anyone get 8.5 hours of sleep every night? And what we wanted to show was that, you know, these people are not doing anything that you can't replicate.
Right.
You know, it's not just like Whoop giving you this crazy unrealistic thing, but like our top sleepers on average were getting, you know, I think it was like 96%. Of their sleep need every single night. So, you know, it is possible to do this night after night. And in a lot of cases, it really doesn't require, you know, a sort of unreasonable or you know, all that intense or expensive change.
And so, just to unpack what you said, sleep need is effectively the amount of hours of sleep that we calculate you need before you go to bed to be fully recovered for the next day or
exactly.
to be optimal for the next day. And so if you have more sleep debt or you take more strain on your body, those are the types of things that would increase your sleep need. If you've been getting a lot of sleep, those are the types of things that would decrease your sleep need. So you're saying that this population, our top 100 sleepers, on average was getting 96% of their sleep performance, right, or of their sleep need. So that means the hours of sleep divided by their sleep need was 96% roughly. So that's really impressive. Now there's an element here of the rich getting richer, because as you get better and better at sleeping, your sleep debt decreases, so that over time it becomes easier to meet that sleep need too, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So somebody who's chronically sleep deprived is going to have a higher sleep need every night because they have that sleep debt from previous nights, and so it's easier to stay on top than it is to sort of get on top. One, like some of the things that we saw that was really interesting is that, you know, they're not giving up all of like the joys of life, right? You know, like they're still drinking caffeine. They're just stopping for the most part, you know, after lunch. And they're still occasionally drinking alcohol. You know, they're still like, you know, some of them do use screen devices in bed. You know, they're just doing it less.
If you look at the behavior of these top 100 sleepers, they still behave like normal people. It's just they have found routines effectively that are more stable.
Yeah, they're just sort of doing it more intelligently, I guess, or more conscientious.
So they'll still drink alcohol, they just won't do it every night.
Yeah.
They'll still look at screen devices, they just won't do it every night.
Yeah, one thing that we kind of saw come up over and over again in their survey responses is that they all have a bedtime routine. You know, they're sort of, there's a lot of talk about good sleep hygiene. So people are, you know, and it comes up in different ways. There's no like one right way to sleep, but, you know, we see either people are meditating or stretching or journaling or, you know, doing something to kind of mark the end of the day and the beginning of the sleep, and that's really helpful.
So those were three of the most common.
Mm-hmm.
You've got stretching, meditating, and what was the third?
Journaling.
Journaling.
Yeah.
What other ones did you hear of?
I mean, we saw a lot of things like, you know, a lot of people were talking about, like, putting their phones away, you know.
So not sleeping with a phone by the bed.
Yeah. I mean, we even saw cute things. Like, a bunch of people mentioned, like, you know, they take their dog for a walk and you know, they put their pets to bed. And that, you know, it's just, I think that there's something really healthy about, you know, creating that, like, moment of separation between, like, just day and night instead of, like, what a lot of, I think, unhealthy sleep patterns that people have. You see people, they're, like, they're working on their couch and then they bring their laptop into bed and they kind of like work until they fall asleep. And then so you don't really have that like separation. And so your brain just gets confused because you're like, I'm trying to work. So I need to like, you know, try and produce all these stimulating hormones, but I'm also in bed. And so then you start to like lose that association of like bed being for sleep. And so it almost doesn't matter what you do as long as like you're creating that like moment of separation. So like taking a hot shower, you know, and just kind of like after I shower, I put on pajamas and then I'm, you know, not doing any more work can just be really helpful.
Now, did you find that these top 100 sleepers also had a high sleep consistency?
Yes. So that was one of the things that we sort of selected them for.
Okay.
But we didn't actually use those words, that language, in our survey intentionally. And we did see over and over that people were mentioning that, like, and they also didn't know that they were selected because of sleep consistency. We just told them, you're a top sleeper. Tell us about your sleep.
And we should probably define sleep consistency quickly.
Sure. So sleep consistency is what it sounds like. So it's the consistency with which your like bedtime and wake time night after night. So it's like if I went to bed at 9 o'clock yesterday, how close to 9 o'clock did I go to bed today? If I woke up at, you know, 6 o'clock this morning, how close to 6 o'clock did I wake up yesterday? And so we're looking at not just for sleep, but also things like naps and whatnot. But it's basically like, do you have a stable sleep-wake pattern? And it's a really good predictor of, like, the health of your circadian rhythm.
And there was a big study on this recently, correct?
Yeah. So in the summer of 2017, Dr. Andrew Phillips published a paper in Nature, which came out of Harvard, in which he looked at, he called it sleep regularity, but basically the consistency of bedtime wake time in Harvard undergraduates and their GPA. And he found that he had a consistent group and an inconsistent group, and then he had this like middle group, which he threw out. And he found that the consistent sleepers did not actually average more sleep over the semester than the inconsistent sleepers did, but they did have higher GPAs. And what was really cool about that was that it showed sort of for the first time that this other dimension, so like not just sleep duration, which sort of is obviously going to be associated with a higher GPA, but sleep consistency was able to predict academic performance. And we got really excited about that because what we found over and over again, like every study we've done, is that like, you know, the things that predict performance of one type seem to predict performance of another type. And so we were like, well, I wonder if this holds up in athletic performance. And so, you know, the Phillips study used 60 athletes. We used 20,000, and we were able to validate in our own data that, in fact, like, we did see that same relationship when we ran this sleep regularity calculation that Phillips proposed in his paper on WHOOP data. We saw that people who had higher sleep regularity also had improved performance. And then we ended up modifying the metric quite a bit. His looked at you know, today versus yesterday, and we sort of extended that to look at 4-day periods and made a couple of other changes. But sort of building off of that, we're able to create a new score.
Well, this goes back to my original pitch to you of why to join WHOOP. Like, you're instead of, you know, looking at data on 80 people, you're able to do it on tens of thousands and millions of data sets. And, you know, as a result, I think the implications can be a lot more powerful. And that's what you and your team did a phenomenal job updating the WHOOP Sleep Coach to now give you feedback on when to go to bed and when to wake up based on optimizing for sleep consistency as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to transition to talk about some new sleep features. that we're releasing as part of World Sleep Day and World Sleep Month. We're really thinking of March as our World Sleep Month. What is sleep efficiency?
So sleep efficiency is the percentage of the time in bed that you're actually asleep.
Okay. And I understand this is now in the Whoop app and on the Whoop dashboard online.
Yeah. So you can see your sleep efficiency in the one-day view on the web and also in the mobile apps. And you can also on the web look at sort of trends in sleep efficiency over weeks or months. And on the team view, for those of you who are on a team, you can sort your team by sleep efficiency as well and look at aggregates by athlete.
And this is on the web dashboard.
All on the web dashboard.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, what is a good sleep efficiency?
So the average Whoop user actually has a sleep efficiency of 94%, which
that's
when I saw
good.
I was pretty impressed.
Yeah.
What the sort of the most interesting thing about sleep efficiency is that by looking at total wake time, sleep efficiency, and sort of sleep latency, you can start to get a sense of, like, if you're having trouble sleeping, sort of where that trouble is coming from. So, like, people who have long sleep latency, so that's the time it takes you from when you sort of say, I'm going to sleep now, until you're actually asleep, have a very different problem than somebody who, like, once they fall asleep, has trouble staying asleep. And so by breaking down, like, that relationship between when you're in bed and when you're sleeping into these different components, you can better target sort of what the appropriate intervention to improve it would be. So we're just trying to kind of break down. It's really information our users already have because we show them total time awake, but by breaking it down, it makes it like a little bit more actionable and easier to track.
Okay, well, I want to come back to that because I've got a couple follow-up questions on what you just said. Respiratory rate. That's also now something we're introducing. Mm-hmm. Explain respiratory rate.
So respiratory rate is the number of breaths per minute, and we measure it only during sleep. And we actually, sort of behind the scenes, without surfacing it to the user, have been calculating respiratory rate for a long time now. And we do that because it helps us in our sleep staging algorithm. But the reason why we've decided now to surface that information to the user is that we've found that it's actually a really useful metric, and it's a very stable metric. So in a lot of ways, it's telling you something very similar to what your resting heart rate is, which is why we didn't initially surface it. It's sort of a measure of fitness, but it's very stable day to day. So like over the last month, my respiratory rate has ranged from like 14.4 to 14.7, which is like a really small band.
So 14.4 breaths per what?
Per minute.
Okay.
And the only time that it like sort of really deviated from that really tight band was when I was on a red eye flight to Iceland, and then it went up to like 17.9. And so any kind of deviation from normal is really easy to see, and it tends to be significant. Whereas like my resting heart rate and my HRV during that same month have like varied a lot more. So like my HRV has varied from like, you know, 40 to 120. So if you see a spike in HRV, it's not always quite as obvious that like something's up. That's like, wow, that was a big deal, because it like varies. Just there's a lot of just normal variability. And so having like that really stable metric can just make it like a really easy sign. And then obviously like kind of interpreting that alongside, like if you see a resting heart rate spike up or an HRV spike down, you can kind of go like, is that real? And then like the respiratory rate is just like a third way of sort of validating that like something's going on.
So generally speaking, a lower resting heart rate, a higher heart rate variability, and a lower respiratory rate are all going to kind of follow one another.
Yeah, and the lower your resting heart rate and respiratory rate and the higher your HRV, generally speaking, like the fitter you are, and then obviously it's true as well.
And then the other thing to keep in mind is it's also relative, right? Some of these things are somewhat genetic. HRV is especially genetic.
Yeah, so your resting heart rate, you know, is as much a function of like the size of your heart as it is the health. So it's not all that like helpful to sort of say like, oh, your, you know, resting heart rate's 2 beats higher than mine, so I'm, you know, more fit than you. But it's a really useful metric to track internally, because obviously like all those genetic factors are held constant over time. So if I see my own resting heart rate going down, then I know that like I'm getting more fit.
Don't women have slightly smaller hearts than men?
Yeah, actually, it's not even that slight. They're about like 30% smaller.
Okay, I was hedging there. But
no, they're significantly smaller. And I mean, in general, like, you know, somebody who's like a larger person is going to have a larger heart as well. So you can kind of look at somebody.
Although, like the brain, for example, isn't that pretty constant size across all humans?
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at people, like, you know, our heads are pretty constant too. So that makes sense.
Right. I'm just thinking, like, generally speaking, organs.
Right. Not every organ scales.
Yeah, not every organ scales to the size of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, women have, generally speaking, higher resting heart rates.
Mm-hmm. And probably higher respiratory rates. And then also with women, one of the other things that's really interesting about respiratory rate is that for women who are not on hormonal birth control, during the luteal and menstrual phases of the menstrual cycle, respiratory rate increases. And there's a really interesting study done in 1992 at the Bangalore Medical Institute and Research Center, which showed that that increase in respiratory rate that's like associated with the menstrual cycle is also associated with a concurrent decrease in exercise capacity. And so what they were showing was that those changes in respiratory rate actually are significant for exercise performance. And so for the WHOOP audience, for those women who are not on oral contraceptives, which kind of you know, make all of this cycling go away,
right.
It's not only interesting potentially for tracking things like fertility, but also for understanding how, you know, different parts of the month that your performance might change. So in terms of like unlocking human performance and helping people understand what's going on, having this like really clean, super easy to see cyclical pattern, it's just like, you know, another way we can kind of keep our users better informed.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm excited about respiratory rate personally. And for all our WHOOP members out there, you know, hopefully you'll start to see how over time we're releasing more and more features, more and more analytics, more and more data to try to improve your body. That's why we think of WHOOP as an ongoing membership and something where it's our responsibility to keep giving you more and more value over time. Okay, I want to transition to taking some questions from WHOOP users. A lot of people ask why they sometimes have low recoveries despite meeting their sleep need. What would be the reason for this?
So there's all kinds of things that can explain. I mean, sleep is sort of one of the things that's like the most in your control for recovery, but sometimes you actually just sort of worked out super hard and, you know, your body does in fact need more time. Sometimes it's because you're sick or you're stressed or there's other external things going on.
Like what?
We had one athlete actually whose mother got diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, wow.
And for like, it was like 6 weeks, she never had anything other than a red score.
Unbelievable.
And
yeah.
Actually, like, you know, we called her coach because this was on the elite side. And,
right.
And so we said, like, you know, something's going on with this athlete. You might want to check in. She's getting, you know, enough sleep.
But can't recover.
Yeah, can't recover. And then the coach sort of was like, hey, you know, what's up? And,
yeah.
You know, all of a sudden she kind of opens up. And so, you know, in that case, it was, you know, there's this cool – sometimes it sort of can tap into things that – you know, maybe, you know, in that case, obviously the athlete knew that why she was stressed. Sometimes it can tell you, though, like, you know, that you're stressed about something you might not actually kind of be aware of. And so it can be that, like, good check-in moment. We actually had one person write into support a couple months ago now, and he basically said, like, you know, I just got on WHOOP, and, you know, I haven't had a green recovery score yet. It's been a week. And I was like, well, you know, tell me about your week. And he's like, well, I moved and I started a new job, but I haven't been drinking, you know, and I've been getting enough sleep. And it's like, well, you know, that's a lot of stress. You know, you move, like, your whole family to a new city.
Yeah, right, it's a lot.
You start a new job. And so, you know, you might not necessarily be like, oh, I'm, like, unhappy, and you could be excited. You know, sometimes excitement, you know, is also, like, a form of stress. But if your body's just, like, hyperactivated because of other things. And so, you know, what I would encourage people to do, obviously, like, sleep is a big thing. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're not going to, you know, get the recovery scores that you want. But if you are getting enough sleep and you're still not getting those good recovery scores, it's like a really good opportunity to kind of have that check-in moment.
Yeah, and in some cases, by the way, you know, it may be like actually seeing a doctor. I mean, we've seen cases where people have been getting enough sleep and they just redlined for 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, we actually had one guy, he wrote into support and he was like, your product is crap. It's been telling me that I'm red and I feel fine. And then, you know, we kind of tried to go through a normal troubleshooting to see what was going on. He wrote back like the day later, still red, feel fine, like I'm going to return this thing. Third day, he writes in, I was just diagnosed with mono. You guys are onto something. It was like, you know, it was this kind of like wonderfully validating moment for me personally, because I was like looking at his data and I was like, I don't know, like what's going on here? And, you know, a lot of times like our bodies know what's going on before we do. And I think those are like
such a good point.
The moments when I think the recovery score, you know, is the most valuable, like in my sort of personal experience. And I've been wearing Whoop for, you know, 4 years now or however long we've had a product.
Yeah, at least five.
5 years.
In some form or another.
In some weird form or another. And, you know, I'd say like 95% of the time, like I look at my recovery score and it's like I could, or like without looking, I could tell you what it was going to be. Like I see it and I'm like, yeah. And 5% of the time you're like, huh? And then, you know, you go for a run anyway or you like whatever and you're like, oh, wow, you know, Whoop was right. Like, you know, I thought I felt good, but then this run was terrible. Or like the opposite happens where it's like I don't feel super great, but Whoop's telling me I'm green, and then I'll go for a run and it'll be like surprisingly good. And sometimes like it just kind of helps you, like, you know, even people who are like pretty in tune with themselves, I think just your body knows more than you do.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And for me personally, mm-hmm. I totally trust Whoop way more than I trust how I feel in the morning. I think most individuals, when they're about to take on something stressful, especially exercise or if you're competing in something, like you can feel in that moment if your body is ready. That's when feelings start to actually kick in. Like you start exerting energy and you're like, oh, wow, maybe I'm a little off today, or wow, I feel great. But I think it's very hard to know that well beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, well beforehand is what matters, because that's when you're figuring out what you should be doing that day. Yeah. So it's a really good point. Those are great antidotes. All right, another question. How long does one poor night of sleep continue to affect recovery? How much does my Saturday affect my Monday and Tuesday?
So whenever you don't get the amount of sleep that you need, you start to accrue a sleep debt, and that can kind of stick around until you pay it off by getting that sleep back, either with napping or an extended sleep later on. What we've seen over and over again is that, you know, Whoop users in general, they try and use like the weekends to catch up on sleep, and that really doesn't work. They'll get, say, average 6 hours of sleep during the week, and then they'll get maybe 8 or 9 over the weekend. But if you need 8 every night, then you're sort of out 10 hours and you're making up for that with an extra 2. There's this really...
Yeah, that's a good way of looking
at it. So, you know, the math actually just really doesn't work out. And then physiologically, it doesn't work out either, even if you somehow manage to get an extra 10 hours of sleep on the weekend, because you're still functioning all week sleep deprived. And so you have this, like, huge sleep deprivation that builds up, and it has physiological consequences in the moment. And so you can kind of, like, catch up and, like, you know, get back. It's almost like your credit score, right? So it's like if you're in debt, right, and your credit score starts to get, like, hit, like, you can pay off your loan, but, like, you still have a bad credit score, right? And it, like, takes a really long time to, like, undo that damage.
Yeah.
Our bodies kind of work like that, too. There's this really fascinating researcher that I follow at Harvard, Orfeo Buxton, and he studies chronic sleep deprivation and how that ties into chronic disease, and he done a ton of work with obesity, type 2 diabetes, cancer, and just like all kinds of like cardiovascular disease stuff like that. And he's found that, like, basically it doesn't matter what chronic disease you're talking about, a huge predictor is not getting enough sleep. And, you know, we see that, like, when we get tired, like, we make poor decisions, and so we're more likely to reach for, like, fatty, salty snacks. And so there's a huge correlation between, like, sleep deprivation and obesity, and then obviously all the things that, like, obesity tends to predict. And when we're better rested, we don't tend to make those, like, bad decisions. And so all the different things that we're doing to, like, compensate for being sleepy, like, you know, we're taking, like, Red Bull, which is, like, not great for our kidneys or whatever, you know, that doesn't get undone just because you, like, sleep in late on a Saturday.
So, I mean, I've played this game personally before, where you've got a week that you just didn't get enough sleep, and then, you play catch up on the weekend. I get that that's suboptimal. If someone's listening right now and they're thinking to themselves, like, well, should I not sleep in on Saturday? What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, obviously, it's better to catch up on sleep than it is
to just keep sleep deprived, right?
So, like, you know, if you happen to be sleep deprived, I would absolutely encourage you to pay off that sleep debt and sleep in. And, you know, we all travel. We all have tough work weeks and stuff happens. So, you know, it's certainly not realistic to say, like, never get into sleep debt ever or you'll die. But, you know, I think what we do want to discourage is this idea that, like, I can sort of week after week after week plan on not getting enough sleep and just, like, sleep in until I, you know, don't feel sleepy on Saturday and Sunday, and that, like, I am breaking even. That's, like, a dangerous mindset, and the data shows that it's just not true. But if you are in that moment, that's way better than saying, like, you know, than never catching up.
Right. And one thing I always try to optimize around is on days where I know I'm not going to be able to get 100% of my sleep need, trying to make sure I get at least 70%.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you on Whoop listening, like, you can go into the sleep coach and you can actually select whether you want to peak or perform or get by tomorrow. And that's going to change from 100% of a sleep need recommendation actually down to a 70%. And then what I've seen with especially college athletes or even some professional athletes is there's this feeling if you can't get 100%, it doesn't really matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's totally wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you want to try to get enough so that you're not taking on this enormous deficit going forwards.
Yeah.
And you do a good job describing that. Okay. Is there a point of diminishing returns? If 9 hours is good, how much better is 10 hours, 12 hours?
Yeah, so one of the things that sort of early into my sleep research days I discovered that I thought was really interesting, or I didn't discover it, I read, is that you can't stockpile sleep. So, like, we store food, right, as fat, and, like, we can store water to a certain extent. But once our bodies have reached they call the state of being sleep replete, so that's getting all the sleep that you need, you can't store up sleep and get extra. And so once you've met your body's need and you're no longer at all sleepy, then it's completely diminishing returns. It's just a waste of time. And there's actually there's a little bit of research that's shown that, like, people who get, like, you know, 10, 11, 12 hours of sleep, obviously, like, sort of athletes and stuff aside who need that, actually have, like, worse health outcomes, likely because they're just sort of rolling around in bed non-productively. So, you know, when we look at sort of how our bodies respond to different amounts of sleep, typically the first part of sleep, so when we're actually the most sleepy, tends to be the most efficient, and the, like, back half of sleep tends to have, like, more disturbances and to become less efficient. And so per, like, hour for hour in bed, it does, you get diminishing returns because it gets less efficient as you go on.
So that goes back to the sleep efficiency mm-hmm. analysis. If you had to look at, you know, data sets on people who spent over 10 hours in bed versus people who spent under 6 hours in bed, would you guess that the sleep efficiency for over 10 hours was lower than the under 6 hours?
Yeah, and that's not even me guessing. There's a lot of research on that. We
sure.
see that, like, people who are chronically sleep deprived, they do tend to get more efficient sleep. And so in this weird way, sometimes having, like, really, really high sleep efficiency can be an indication that you're sleep deprived. It's kind of like if you're super starving and someone, like, lets you loose on a buffet, you're
right.
going to, like, right. eat a ton really quickly versus, like, if you're sort of, you know, have, like, a healthier, more normal appetite, you ate a few hours ago, you're going to, like, survey, take some time. You kind of sleep works the same way that, like, a lot of times you'll see 100% sleep efficiency can actually be a sign that you're not getting enough.
Makes a lot of sense. Okay. This theme is around sleep cycles and staging. Okay, and I actually get this question all the time, too, through Twitter and Instagram. What can I do to get more slow-wave sleep and REM sleep?
So one of the things that we actually just published last week in our sleep consistency locker post was that actually that there is a relationship between sleep consistency and slow-wave sleep and REM sleep.
Okay.
There's actually a bigger relationship between sleep consistency and REM sleep, where people who had the highest sleep consistency were adding an extra 36 minutes of REM sleep per night.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, and sort of our current theory, and this part we haven't been able to validate yet, is that sleep consistency sort of is obviously really closely related to your circadian rhythm. And so if you have high sleep consistency, your body is able to anticipate sleep, which is why we're seeing sleep consistency explains as much as like a 3% difference in sleep efficiency. It explains this difference in slow wave sleep and REM sleep. And we think that that's because when your body's anticipating sleep, it kind of like, it knows what to do. It's like, okay, this is bedtime, and it starts to get all those hormones. You see melatonin rising, like concentrations in the blood start to rise earlier. And so when people actually are ready to go to sleep, their bodies are ready for them to go to sleep. And so you see more of these like restorative phases of sleep. Beyond sleep consistency, which, you know, for anybody who wants more REM sleep and slow wave sleep would be the first thing I'd recommend. It's also worth looking into things like, is your environment conducive to sleep? So, you know, if you're constantly getting woken up, you're going to spend a lot more time in light sleep, which is sort of that transition phase, versus if you have an environment that's super conducive to sleep. So you want to think about things like your room being as dark as possible, as quiet as possible. You want to invest in, like, you know, comfy sheets, you know, that are breathable materials so that your body temperature can kind of, you know, be where you want it to be. You shouldn't be sleeping in a 14-year-old mattress. You know, it's something you want to replace every 7 to 10 years. And you want to make sure that, like, you know, it's not too humid, not too hot, different things like that. You know, obviously in the city, sometimes it can be harder to kind of get all the environmental components sort of where you'd want them to be. So it's worth looking into things like blackout curtains and white noise machines. But a lot of times, sort of when people are having troubles getting deeper stages of sleep, it's sort of more that they're sort of not sleeping well in general.
So for you personally, what are some of the products that you've invested in to improve your sleep? Or what are some of the habits that you have?
Yeah, so when my husband and I moved into our current home, we put custom fit blackout shades in every bedroom.
Smart.
Which, you know, I absolutely love and would recommend to anybody.
And some of this stuff we'll put in the show notes, too. So whatever kind of blackout shades you recommend and these different things.
Well, I'm not super married to any brand in particular. But, you know, we live in the city and, you know, there's streetlights outside of our window.
Right.
And when we first moved in and we were there at night, it was like I could literally read with all the lights off in the middle of the night. There's so much street light, and now it's like I can't see anything, which is
amazing.
Yeah, our circadian rhythms are essentially set by light. And so if you have as little as like 80 lux of light in your bedroom, you're telling your body that it's daytime, which means don't sleep. And so you actually inhibit the production of the sleep-promoting hormone melatonin. And so sort of blackout curtains are one of the best ways to sort of stop telling your body that it's daytime.
How do you feel about eye masks?
Yeah, so that's obviously like a really great and kind of less expensive alternative. I personally don't like wearing them, but for anybody who's traveling, obviously you're not going to bring blackout curtains with you on vacation. So it's like a kind of, if you don't find them uncomfortable, it can be a really good way to get that same effect.
I got into them personally because I travel all the time. Mm-hmm. And when you're sleeping in hotel rooms, the thing that drives me mad about hotel rooms is they have all these goofy lights in mm-hmm. the room. You've got the television red light. You've got the exit sign light.
Yeah.
You've got these bizarre, like, get out of bed safety lights. You've got these alarm clocks that are all lit up. And it's chaos if you're someone like us who, you know, really appreciates darkness. So I would recommend to people who spend a lot of time in hotel rooms to get an eye mask.
Yeah, and that's a great point in general, because even if you have blackout curtains, you know, any light you have inside of the room, you know, isn't going to be affected by them. So things like those tiny little LEDs that are literally everywhere these days, on every clock, on every TV, you can just put a little piece of like electrical tape over them. You don't really need them.
Yeah.
Just like make them go away.
Yeah, I spend like 10 minutes before I go to bed in hotels literally putting props up in front of lights.
Yeah,
I look like a crazy person.
I have a hat over like our internet router because I just like blocking the light.
Yeah, the mounted television with like a hung jacket over the screen to block out the light. How little is 80 lux?
It's pretty little. So, you know, if you put your hand out in front of you, you'd be able to see it, but like you wouldn't necessarily be able to like read an 80 lux.
Okay. So really the point is 80 lux can keep you up, mm-hmm. and that's not a lot of light. So mm-hmm. black out the room, folks.
Yeah.
Now, quiet. Do you do anything of like the white noise machines and stuff like that?
Yeah, so Bose came out with this great product earlier this year, these little sleep pods. And
interesting.
They're using their noise canceling technology, but they specifically tuned it to snoring.
Oh.
So they're not meant, I guess, for general noise, although they do help with that. But they do a really good job if your partner snores. And they don't play music or anything. They're just for sleeping. And so they're a lot smaller than typical like Bluetooth ear pods would be. So they're actually like, I'm a side sleeper, so I was like a little bit skeptical about them being uncomfortable, but they're super comfortable and they're really effective. And you can have them like just do their noise canceling thing, or they have a couple of like preloaded, like you know, babbling brook or rustling leaves, kind of like generic sounds. Super big fan of those.
Interesting. Now you mentioned you're a side sleeper. Mm-hmm. Is there any mm-hmm. like best practices in terms of whether you should sleep on your back or your chest or your side?
So sleeping on your left side is supposed to be good for digestion because it puts your
this is fascinating
sort of like your esophagus through stomach at like a sort of good angle, so that if anybody who has any kind of like acid reflux or anything like that tends to be the most comfortable sleeping like that.
Interesting.
If you have issues with snoring or sleep apnea, sort of sleeping on like a wedge pillow, so on your back but propped up, can be really helpful. Sleeping on your back in general is like really good for your spine, but sleeping on your back and flat can be problematic if you have any of these kind of like sleep-related issues. So some of it has to do with kind of what you're optimizing for, and a little bit just kind of like what you're comfortable with.
And if you're someone who snores, how mm-hmm. can you go about, well, first of all, is that a bad sign?
Mm-hmm.
And then second of all, if you're sleeping with a partner and you want to reduce your snoring, how can you think about that?
Yeah, so one of the best indicators of snoring is weight. And so for a lot of people, something as simple as losing a little bit of weight can definitely help. There's a lot of sort of positional things, so like wedge pillows, which can actually be incredibly comfortable too, to just kind of prop your back up a little bit can help with snoring. Actually, if you're sleeping on your back, rolling over to your side can help with snoring as well. And then if those kind of basic things don't seem to do it, then there's a couple of products that are sort of worth trying. So like a humidifier can help reduce snoring, and then they have the bathroom.
The humidifier in your bedroom.
Mm-hmm. In your bedroom.
To clear the air.
Yeah, and
that
it has
sense.
The added benefit of most of them create a little bit of white noise, so that can help too.
Right.
But then there's a lot of products. Like there's mouth guards that can help kind of open your jaw in such a way that like keeps your airway open. There are these like Breathe Right strips that you can put on your nose, and then sort of if those things aren't
the
working,
strips, those look like what a football player would
yeah.
wear, right, during
mm-hmm.
a game.
Exactly. And then if those things aren't working, then you probably are at the point where you'd want to see a doctor. There's a machine called a CPAP that it's like a little bit more invasive, but if you do have kind of moderate to severe sleep apnea, it's by far the best thing you could possibly be using. But like a lot of people kind of, because they are a little bit more intrusive, you know, it's worth trying those other things I mentioned first.
Okay. Well, we hit a few user questions there. Back to the well. How does my day strain affect my sleep cycles? Do I need more deep sleep after a day with more strain? Great question. And I would also try to tie in, like, is exercising in the morning versus the afternoon versus the evening? Do you see those things affect sleep? So everything related to exercise, strain, and sleep.
All right. So a couple different things. So in the locker post that we released on the 25th about sleep efficiency, we saw that there's a relationship between day strain and sleep efficiency.
Interesting.
And it's not necessarily exactly what you'd expect. So what we saw was that people who had really low day strain had worse sleep efficiency. And then it rises, peaks sort of in the mid to high teens, and then actually declines when you get up to like the highest strain. And there's a lot of literature about what might be going on sort of at that higher end, where, like, if you produce a lot of catecholamines, which are, like, associated with stress, that it's just your body's kind of, like, too revved up to get good sleep. And so we definitely seen that, like, when you're if you exercise really, really hard, sometimes that can make it harder to sleep at night, which is a little bit counterintuitive, so it was interesting to see that.
So I just want to make sure I've got this phenomenon clear. If I don't exercise at all, I'm more likely to have less efficient sleep.
Mm-hmm.
As I start to increase my strain up to a certain point,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to increase efficiency, and it's almost like a linear path in that regard. Now, once I get over what strain would you say, 18?
No. Well, it sort of starts to like peak at like 14 to 16.
So 14 to 16 is the peak strain, is the perfect strain to get the most efficient sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. And then past 16, it starts to decay.
Yeah, so it kind of plateaus for a little bit, and then you see it decay, and it decays actually really dramatically, like for the 19s and 20s.
So if you get a 20 on Whoop, you actually maybe are going to have a lower sleep efficiency
mm-hmm.
than if you actually didn't work out at all.
Right, and one of the reasons why that's interesting is you're actually going to have a higher sleep need. And so there's this linear, sort of pseudo-linear relationship between your sleep need and how hard you work out, because basically, when you are exercising, you're kind of beating your body up. You're kind of
no doubt,
and so you're creating this like need to recover. And you know, we produce 95% of human growth hormone during slow wave sleep, and so you need to give yourself that opportunity to sleep in order to
say that again, because that's so important.
So we produce 95% of the human growth hormone.
I mean, isn't that fucking crazy? It's like the idea that you get stronger in the gym is actually totally false. You get stronger sleeping.
Yes, you actually get a lot weaker in the gym, which I think, like, while it sounds a little funny, like, anybody who's ever worked out definitely feels that way, right? Like,
I mean, I didn't realize it was 95%. I knew it was a lot, but that's, I mean, that's amazing, right?
Yeah, and I think that it, like, really gets to, you know, like, a lot of the information that kind of Whoop can help people with. So like a lot of times, like athletes will have like this really, you know, hard game or really hard practice, and they go celebrate with beers. And so it's like the worst thing you can do, because like, you know, if you then don't allow yourself to like get the sleep after working out, then you don't have that opportunity to respond by producing that growth hormone. You know, slow wave sleep is going to be inhibited if you're drunk. And so you know, kind of, you want to make sure not just that you get enough sleep before a tough workout so that you're able to do the workout, but that you're getting enough sleep after your workout. And that's the place where we actually see a lot of Whoop athletes, you know, kind of the more they're on Whoop, the more they start to get that and correct that behavior. Because if you have a really tough workout, a lot of times you have a rest day the next day. And so people think like, oh, I don't have a workout tomorrow, so I can stay up late, or I can like go out tonight, or whatever
right,
it is.
Yeah.
And like that's actually where you're like leaving the most potential gains on the table. Like you want to get the most sleep that night, because that's when you're going to get that like return on the workout investment. So if you want to maximize the like, you know, ROI of your workout, get a lot of sleep that the night after.
Is it better to exercise in the morning or the evening?
So we actually did a research project 2 years ago, and we looked at both sleep and sleep efficiency after working out within 4 hours of bedtime, which is sort of one of the common recommendations you hear thrown around, like don't exercise within 4 hours of bed. And we found that that sort of general advice was actually like not very helpful. For like the average workout, 4 hours before bed did not have an impact on sleep efficiency. If you start to break that down and you look at like the really intense workouts, so things that are scoring like an 18 and above, and you start to see that that does sort of harm sleep. And if you look at, you know, the closer to bed, the more that relationship starts to come out. So you don't want to do something really, really intense. So like, you know, working out above your anaerobic threshold within, say, 2 hours of bed. But from all the data we've looked at, like, if you want to just kind of, you know, go for, like, a light jog or anything like that, our data does not show that that has an effect on sleep if it's 4 hours before bed.
Okay. Can excessive REM sleep be bad? My sleep is consistent, but some days I get 3 hours of REM sleep and about 15 minutes of slow wave sleep and have no idea why.
So one of the things that, because we actually get questions like that a lot, And one of the things I always tell people is that your body kind of knows how to allocate its sleep time. So REM sleep, I guess to back up, is the mentally restorative part of sleep. And deep sleep or slow wave sleep is the physically restorative part of sleep. And so our body's going to allocate time between slow wave sleep and REM sleep based on like what it feels the needs are. One of the things that we often see when people get a ton of REM sleep is actually that it can be a sign of acute sleep deprivation, because typically slow wave sleep happens earlier in the night and REM sleep happens later in the night. And so if you go to bed, say, last night and you woke up earlier than your body was anticipating, you've disproportionately cut off REM sleep, because that's what would have happened had you stayed asleep, whereas you probably got most of your slow wave sleep earlier in the night. And so then the next night, it's like almost as if you have a REM sleep debt, and you sort of got your normal amount of slow wave sleep, but you didn't get that normal amount of REM sleep, and so your body responds by getting like a compensatory amount of REM sleep the night after. And so if you're sort of seeing that like every so often, it's a sign of acute sleep debt.
Interesting.
But in general, sort of, as long as you're getting into the deeper stages of sleep, you can sort of trust that your body's allocating it according to what it needed.
Sometimes I have nights with only 2 to 3 minutes of slow wave sleep. Can I still trust the HRV reading that morning?
Yeah. So slow wave sleep and light sleep often get talked about as if they're like, you know, two different things, when in reality there's a continuum of, like, you know, the lightest light sleep to the deepest slow wave sleep, and sort of in between you have deep-ish light sleep and lightish slow wave sleep. And so what Whoop's actually doing behind the scenes is we have like a sort of how deep is your sleep metric continuously. And so when you don't have true slow wave sleep, sometimes you're in almost slow wave sleep. And so if we see a lot of almost slow wave sleep later in the night, we can take the resting heart rate and HRV then.
Got it. Here's a theme around sleeping unusual hours. I'm a police officer who works night shifts. How can I minimize how that affects my body? That's tough.
That is tough. So shift work is actually associated with all kinds of, you know, every type of cancer, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. It's one of the hardest things you can do to your body. But the sort of the reality is that like people have to do it.
Sure.
So given that it's not going anywhere, the best thing you can possibly do is to try and maintain that schedule. A lot of people, they'll try and like switch back on the weekends, you know, for social reasons, especially if they have a family or anything like that, and that can make it a lot harder. I think embracing things like, you know, things to control your environment, because you're fighting the environment even more. So like blackout curtains, stuff like that. I think taking melatonin to help your body override sort of any daytime signals it might be getting.
So melatonin as a supplement.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of melatonin as a supplement.
How often do you take it?
Whenever I travel, and if I ever just don't feel sleepy.
And what does what is taking melatonin as a supplement actually do to your body?
So we produce melatonin naturally, and we start producing melatonin about 2 hours before we're anticipating sleep. But if our sleep cycles aren't consistent, then our bodies don't know when to anticipate sleep. And so if you take melatonin, you sort of get that concentration up as if it was happening naturally, and then you're sort of telling your body like, hey, I'm going into sleep mode, and it helps you like calm down and relax. And one of the sort of things that makes melatonin so safe is that it has a really short half-life, so it actually gets out of your body within like, you know, a couple hours. It's all gone. And so what you're sort of relying on is that your natural production of melatonin like takes over at that point. So unlike something like Ambien, which can last like 8 hours, or like, you know, these more like sedative hypnotics that are meant to keep you asleep all night, melatonin's really only going to help you fall asleep. But then once you're asleep, you can sort of maintain it.
Well,
yourself.
You turned me on to melatonin, and I take it, I would say, 90% of the time when I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. And probably when I'm at home and kind of normal work schedule, I'll take it once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. And now, if someone's listening to this and they're like, I just have trouble sleeping, I want to take this every night, would you recommend that, or do you think that's riskier?
To my knowledge, melatonin's not habit-forming. It's sort of been available as a supplement for a really long time. It's been pretty well studied. I think it's really safe. The place where, you know, where I the only reason I'd be hesitant is that melatonin really is only going to help you fall asleep. You'd have to, like, redose yourself in the middle of the night for help staying asleep, because if you take it, it's just going to clear out within a few hours.
We talked in the beginning about how there's two categories of challenges mm-hmm. with sleep, right? One is the falling asleep mm-hmm. challenge, and the other is staying asleep. Mm-hmm. So you're saying melatonin is more helpful for falling asleep,
yeah, and
less helpful for staying asleep.
But if you haven't, you know, an environment, and I keep saying this, that's like conducive to sleep, typically once you're asleep, you can just stay asleep.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to take if your mind's, like, awake or, you know, you're...
Yeah, it can kind of help you, like, turn off.
Yeah, that's how I think about it, too. Mm-hmm. Now, how about some other supplements while we're on the topic related to sleep? What are some things that come to mind?
So for people who are magnesium-deprived, taking magnesium can help a ton. My big caveat with that is if you're not magnesium-deprived, it's not going to help. So you're just sort of wasting money. And you don't want to overdose on magnesium, so I wouldn't recommend going totally crazy.
And when you say overdose, like, what are the appropriate doses for things like melatonin, magnesium? It's probably different for each.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. The big thing with magnesium, which is why I think at Whoop we kind of bring it up a lot, is that athletes tend to be magnesium deprived.
Right.
Because we kind of consume magnesium in working out.
Right.
So the more you're working out, kind of the more... it's something you want to, like, pay attention to. You'll sort of know that it's working for you. You'll notice that you're, like, dreaming more and stuff like that. If not dreaming and, like, not staying asleep isn't a problem that you have, I wouldn't necessarily recommend starting it. Zinc is another one. It's really only going to help if you're zinc deprived, which, you know, not everybody is. But, you know, if you are zinc deprived, it's a great, you know, kind of safe place to start.
Now, if someone's listening to this and they're like, all right, I'm going to go buy some supplements and try stuff, which, by the way, I recommend for anyone, just go try these things and see how it affects your data. What are brands that you recommend, or do you think with something like melatonin, it's kind of like everything's relatively the same?
No. So supplements are not considered drugs by the FDA. They're considered food. And the reason why that matters is that all the FDA cares about is that they're safe to consume, not that they're at all potent. So, like, most of the calcium on the market, for example, is not what they call bioavailable. So something that says it has, like, X number of milligrams of calcium, it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, that's what's going to get into your bloodstream. Like, most of that just becomes expensive pee. And so, you know, two different products that have the same, you know, milligrams of calcium could result in very different calcium that gets absorbed. And, you know, that's true about absolutely every supplement on the market. Mm. And so a lot of times if you're, like, in, you know, CVS or wherever you are, and you're like, why is, you know, this brand, like, 40 times more expensive than this one? I'm just going to get the cheap one. You know, that's kind of what you want to look at, like, you know, a lot of times with supplements, you see, like, they're bound with, like, carrier proteins that help with absorption. Like, calcium's almost always with, like, D3, which is going to help you absorb it. A lot of cheap calcium is just crushed up shells. Your body's going to do very little with that. But expensive calcium is more expensive.
So generally speaking, spending a little more money on your supplements is worth it.
Well, doing the research to find out where they're from. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to spend the most money, but you want to make sure that they're a bioavailable form.
Which melatonin do you use?
Nature Made.
Nature Made. I use Nature Made as well. We'll include that in the show notes.
We use 5 milligrams sort of. One of the things that's, like, important with melatonin is how it's bound and how, like, it's prepared will determine how quickly we break it down. So, like, things that are, like, oil-based supplements, a lot of times will get into your blood system faster than things that are, like, more solid because you have to digest them. So you get almost, like, a little bit of a slow release. And because the half-life is so short once it gets into your bloodstream, having, like, that slow release effect can help, like, sustain the benefits.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I used to take melatonin as, like, something that I would swallow, and now I take the nature-made ones where they dissolve.
Mm-hmm.
And given that the reason I'm taking it is to fall asleep quickly, I like the ones that dissolve.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with, like, how you're using it. So, like, if you're just sort of, like, trying to turn your brain off and, like, stop thinking about work and fall asleep and you know that you can sustain the sleep afterwards, that's great. If you're trying to use it for jet lag purposes, having, like, it lasts a little bit longer can be helpful because your jet lag can keep you up.
Okay, back to unusual hours. One person writes, the Romans didn't sleep 8 straight hours. They would break up their sleep into 2 chunks. So where did this idea we need 8 straight hours come from?
So it's not just the Romans who did that. We actually see references in the literature as late as like the 1800s. We see it in like people's diaries, and you know, Charles Dickens is writing about first sleep and second sleep in the 1840s. And so this phenomenon is actually it's much more recent than the Romans, that you know, we're sleeping in one straight period. It actually seems to be correlated with the Industrial Revolution, that all of a sudden like sort of work hours became more consolidated and people were sort of starting to be busier, and just like a lot of things, kind of there are cultural shifts that made it sort of inconvenient to have those 2 sleep periods. What we see from again like diaries and the literature sort of prior to that is that people would sort of sleep when it started to get dark out, and then they'd wake up in the middle of the night for a few hours, and that was like a really important social time. So you know, they would eat, have sex,
right.
Kind of different things like that, which probably, you know, they'd get home from their day job exhausted, and so you didn't want to like then, you know, do something else, and so you would kind of crash for a little bit, and then in the middle of the night, you know, do things that you can do by candlelight, and then go back to sleep until it was light enough to go out and work again. And we actually, there's a study that was done in 1992 by Thomas Weir at the National Institute for Mental Health, and he took a whole bunch of people for 30 days, and he gave them 14 hours to sleep. So they were in a dark room. They could do whatever they wanted, but, like, they sort of had to stay in there for 14 hours. And after, like, a few days of adjusting, every single one of them, adapted this biphasic sleeping pattern where they'd sleep for about 4 hours, and then they'd, like, roll around and kind of be awake for 1 to 3 hours, and then they'd have a second sleeping period. So there's actually, like, some pretty good evidence that that is, like, a natural way of doing things, but we just don't have 14 hours. And when was the last time you'd like 14 hours to hang out in bed? And so we kind of delay that first sleeping period because we're so busy, and then you know, we have to get up 8 hours later, so we just kind of stay in bed. So I think that idea really came from sort of changing work-life balance ideas and just kind of social expectations more than any kind of like it's not better, it's not natural. And we actually I'd argue that it hasn't gone away. Like, siesta is a big thing in a lot of the world, so where people are taking kind of afternoon naps.
So that brings us to another question. Is napping good?
Napping is a great way to reduce sleep debt, but not all naps are sort of created equally. There's this great kind of little napping trick called, like, the caffeine nap, where you have a cup of coffee, and then you fall asleep. And it takes about, like, 20, 30 minutes for the caffeine to, like, kind of kick in. And so it happens, and then you wake up naturally 20 minutes later because the caffeine's kicking in. So you don't get, like, too groggy or anything because, like, you're kind of getting, like, drugged awake.
Like, a little bit
of, like, a perky thing. But you do get, like, a 20 minutes where you're most likely quite
tired. Have you ever done this?
Of good sleep, yeah.
Wow.
So you kind of
you've kept that to yourself for 6 years, Emily. You could have shared that with me.
You never asked.
I could have used a caffeine nap one of these days.
So you kind of have to, like, do it right. Like, you can't, like, savor the coffee. You need to, like, kind of knock it back a little bit.
Right.
But one of the sort of, like, pitfalls with napping is sometimes, like, you get into sleep, and then you wake yourself up in, like, a deep stage of sleep, and then you feel groggy, and it's almost like you feel worse than you did before the nap. And so, like, the kind of caffeine trick can help prevent that, like, grogginess feeling. The other big pitfall with naps is if you're napping within, like, 6-ish hours of bedtime, sometimes it can make it harder to fall asleep because you do, like, if you do kind of more than just, like, taking the edge off, then all of a sudden, like, your sleep need isn't, like, high enough at bedtime, so then you're, like, not tired, and then you can almost become, like, the equivalent of sort of, like, jet-lagged.
So that's a good segue. What advice do you have for people changing time zones and people traveling a lot?
So for anybody who's changing time zones, like 1 or 2 time zones, I almost, like, would advise, like, just pretend you're not. If you're only going away for, like, a few days or, like, a weekend, like, just stay on your home time zone. It's often totally
possible. Again, if your goal is to optimize for your body.
Yeah.
stay on your own time zone.
Yeah, so it's like if I'm obviously in Boston right now. If I go to Chicago, if I just stay on Boston time, then I'm not even going to notice that, like, I was in a different time zone. So sometimes that can just be the easiest way to kind of
Now say you're flying to Africa from Boston,
sure.
Right?
Or like, well, if you're going to Europe or Africa or anywhere further than a couple of time zones away, getting as much daytime light exposure as possible is going to help your circadian rhythm. In the new place, yeah. So as much daytime light exposure. You use caffeine, but, you know, especially if you're sort of typically a coffee drinker, it can be really powerful. Try and avoid alcohol. That can just kind of confuse your system and you're not going to get good quality sleep. And getting a little bit of exercise in your new time zone, especially outdoor exercise, can help a ton. Because if you do something to kind of help your body, like, get tired, that's going to help a lot.
And say you're someone who's like, I can't sleep on planes. I've got a red eye. I absolutely need to be able to get some rest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for that person, would you say it's okay to take a more intense sleep drug like an Ambien or something like that?
Well, I'm never going to recommend Ambien. I think that stuff's terrifying.
Okay.
But, I mean, I would say, like, you know, if it feels like it's a pathological thing, certainly consult your doctor.
Sure.
But, you know, melatonin, I think, you know, it's more powerful than a lot of people realize, especially as, you know, we were talking about earlier, if you get the good stuff. So make sure it's bioavailable, you know, from a reputable company. But that's going to get you a lot of the way.
Now, what terrifies you about Ambien?
So Ambien actually is this, like, amazing case study where not all that recently, almost all medical research was done exclusively on men. And so none of the Ambien, like, dosing stuff was research was done on women.
And that was somewhat intentional.
And, well, sort of women were considered, like, to have too many variables because, like, the menstrual cycle, like,
okay.
Sort of scared researchers. But it turns out that women respond to Ambien, like, way stronger than men do, and the recommended dose should be, like, half of what it is for, like, an equal-sized male.
Oh, wow.
And so women were getting, like, way, like, overdosed on Ambien, and it was making them do, like, pretty crazy stuff. Like, sometimes one of the sort of not all that uncommon side effects with Ambien is that you get, like, you have these, like, really crazy dreams, and sometimes you'll, like, sleepwalk or sleep talk and act out these crazy dreams. And so people have committed some, like, really serious crimes, really hurt themselves and other people while fully thinking they were asleep. There's, like, a number of lawsuits. You can look them up. Like, people have killed people. People have driven and crashed cars.
Right.
People have acted out their wild sex fantasies on people who were not consenting.
Oh, wow.
And the whole time and then they woke up the next morning and they thought they had a wild dream and then, you know, got arrested. And so, you know, it's...
Oh, wow.
I think I certainly would not try a drug like that for the first time on a plane. You want to know how your body is going to respond to that, and I would definitely do that under, you know, pretty close, competent medical supervision. Like, I don't think that's just like a, you know, I have trouble sleeping, let me kind of take the edge off kind of a drug. That's like for people with real problems and should be sort of used carefully.
Okay, so somewhat related, how do you think about nutrition, diet as it relates to sleep? So, will I potentially have worse sleep if I eat the wrong things for dinner?
Yeah, and probably dinner is the most relevant. You know, I don't know how much breakfast and lunch is going to affect sleep. Having really, like, heavy, fatty foods, especially if you're trying to go to bed relatively close to the end of dinner, can cause kind of, like, indigestion, acid reflux, and all those kinds of things that sort of get exacerbated by lying down. So having, like, a lot of fat right before bed can be problematic if you suffer.
What do you consider
like
is
that?
Right before bed? Like, how many hours between dinner and going to bed do you think is, like, appropriate?
You know, that depends a little bit on the individual. Like, some people have, you know, higher gastric motility, so they kind of process food faster than other people. You know, I'd say, like, you know, a couple hours, three. You know, I think if you're eating dinner at 6 and going to bed at 1 a.m., then, like, you can probably eat whatever you want. But if you're, you know, dining and eating until 9 and then, you know, getting in bed 10:30, 11, you might kind of, especially if, like, you kind of have, like, a big piece of cake or
sure.
something, you know, desserts tend to be kind of fatty. So you're, like, backloading that stuff. You might feel it. And it's, you know, it's a little bit of self-experimentation. Like, you know, it only needs to happen to you once before you're like, well, this sucked, I'm not going to do that again.
Right. And by the way, that's one thing I've noticed personally. Like, I don't have that many different variables if I'm just, you know, in Boston for a week. Different foods I've found can affect my sleep and my recovery considerably.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of foods we can eat at dinner that can be sleep promoting. So, you know, everybody knows that kind of like
turkey,
right? So like the tryptophan in turkey helps you sleep. What people don't know is that like dairy has a lot more tryptophan than turkey does. And so you can sort of having dairy at night, and there's a reason why
I'm lactose intolerant, Emily.
Well, there's a reason why we give little kids like a warm bottle at night.
Right. That makes sense.
That's like very sleep promoting.
So you would actually recommend people drinking milk to fall asleep?
If you're not lactose intolerant, a warm glass of milk, yeah.
And why warm?
So warm actually, like, so there's this interesting phenomenon where your core body temperature falling is actually sleep promoting, and so getting your core warm so that it can then cool off helps you fall asleep. So it's basically the same idea as like taking a hot bath or a warm shower, why that kind of can make you feel sleepy. It's also why like drinking chamomile tea is super, chamomile has certain sleep promoting properties in general, but you know it's something super comforting about that. It can also just help with like stress, it feels good. So a warm glass of milk, you know, you're gonna get the tryptophan, you get like a little bit of fat, which is nice. And then kind of that warming effect, which enables the cooling effect that promotes sleep.
What are some other foods that you think help people fall asleep or sleep better?
So tart cherry juice actually has melatonin in it. And so it's like a really great all-natural way of, if like, you're not kind of a supplement or a drug person, to kind of get that same effect. You won't really get it from just drinking, from eating cherries, because you'd have to eat just an offensive amount of cherries. That's why I'd recommend the juice, but that's a good one. And then kind of anything that's going to make you feel, like, good and comfortable. And we talked earlier about, like, a bedtime routine, so anything that's habitual can be really effective. And then I'd say just, like, being aware of hidden sources of caffeine. So, like, chocolate, actually, and dark chocolate can have, like, a decent amount of caffeine in it.
Right.
And so, like, not having hot chocolate and thinking that that's the same thing is, like...
Right.
I mean, I don't know how many of us are doing that, but... kind of being aware of things like that.
How about hydration? Like, I like to drink a lot of water before bed.
Yeah, so being hydrated will help with your sleep. Being dehydrated can cause all kinds of stress responses and inefficiencies that will sort of show up in your sleep. But you need to balance that with not waking up, you know, throughout the night to pee, which I know a lot of people sort of, like, cut themselves off. You know, after like 8 or 10 o'clock in order to avoid that. So I think it's a little bit of like knowing your body. Obviously, you want to be as hydrated as possible without like having it cause you to need to get up in the middle of the night.
Do you think there's a minimum amount of time between like how much you drink and when you go to bed?
I mean, I think...
Well, I guess on the flip side of that, right? Let me ask a better question. Is there a minimum amount of time for alcohol for it to not affect the way you sleep?
Yes and no. I mean, like, if your blood alcohol content has returned to zero, right, then it's going to have less of an effect on your sleep than if you are, in fact, drunk at the moment when you go to sleep. And so depending on sort of, you know, the sort of general rule of thumb is that, like, we can process, like, one standard drink per hour. So if it's been, like, however many hours, like, since you've been drinking, then... you should be sober when you go to bed.
What does the data look like for sleep when you're drunk?
Oh, it's hilarious. So your heart rate tends to be really high, and you actually see
this is so cool.
Of exponential decay in the heart rate as you sober up. And we typically see very little of the restorative stages, if not none of the restorative stages, until you sort of reach that, like, sort of sobered up baseline, which can be 3-4 hours into the night if you've been drinking heavily close to bed.
So anyone who's been on Whoop for long enough who also drinks will at some point have this experience. Mm-hmm. And I encourage you to go look at the sleep data, and you'll see the heart rate comes down dramatically. Mm-hmm. You'll see that, like, REM and slow wave don't happen during that period when the heart rate is elevated and dropping. And then inevitably your recovery the next day is affected.
Yeah.
What constitutes as a disturbance, according to Whoop?
So disturbances are brief periods of being awake that are typically so short that the user won't typically be aware of them the next morning. So it's like when you wake up and like roll over and then fall back asleep. We actually do this on average about 9 times per night. And the idea is that like you don't know that they happened. If I ask you the next morning, you won't report them, but they can account for a significant amount of wake time. And there's something that different behavioral interventions and environmental changes can help reduce. So it's something you can kind of target as like a source of lost sleep efficiency.
What are something that I could do to reduce my sleep disturbances?
So it's anything that's going to improve sleep in general.
Okay, someone writes, I go to bed early, 9-ish, and I spend plenty of time in bed, but sometimes I'll wake up at 3 or 4 a.m., 2 to 3 hours before I'd like to, and can't get back to sleep. Any tips for this or ideas of what I'm doing wrong?
So that's like we talked about, that's the natural way for humans to sleep. One of the things that's really interesting about sort of...
So this person needs to just play around,
yeah, they're
have
just
sex,
like a Roman,
and then,
you know?
And then go back.
One of the things that's really interesting is that sort of in the like 1800s, we start to see like sort of talk in the literature and in diaries and stuff of like first sleep and second sleep starts to disappear. And right around the same time, we start to see the first reports in the literature of sleep maintenance insomnia, which is like people who have trouble like staying asleep. And so it's sort of this new medical problem that we created by this unnatural sleep pattern of like sleeping one consolidated 8 hour period. So like what we're doing is a little bit unnatural. It's sort of a convenience thing that most of us seem to be able to get away with, but the fact that like so many people have this issue where they fall asleep, they sleep for a few hours, and then they're like, what the hell, you know, exhausted, but like can't fall asleep between like in that middle of the night, like that's natural,
right?
So it's tough to sort of say that like they are the ones that need to fix. It's like society sort of screwed them.
How about dreaming? If someone's not dreaming, is there anything that's a sign of?
Yeah, so we predominantly have, like, our most intense dreams during REM sleep. There's sort of, like, two different kinds of dreams. There's, like, what they call, like, fantastical dreams, and those are, like, the fun ones where you're, like, flying or, like, won the lottery or whatever. And then there's, like, boring dreams where you're, like, in a meeting or, like, making breakfast or whatever.
Yeah.
We tend to have, like, the boring dreams during light sleep and the fantastical dreams during REM sleep. If you're, like, not dreaming, one of two things is going on. Either you are dreaming and you're just waking up not during a dream, and so you just don't remember it, which is actually like...
You immediately forget it.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's not just like... Like sometimes you wake up and the dream's kind of like on the tip of your tongue, you know, that feeling,
yeah,
and then
yeah,
it goes away, but like you're aware that you dreamt. But if you wake up during like slow wave sleep, a lot of times you weren't in the middle of a dream when you woke up. And so then you're just like, oh, I didn't dream. But like if you actually like had an EEG on, there'd be evidence that you were dreaming. So a lot of people who think they don't dream do dream. They just forget about it. But if you're in fact not
it's
dreaming...
It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the positive is that you are dreaming. But
yeah.
I feel like the actual memory of dreams is important,
yeah,
for some reason.
But if you're in fact not dreaming, I mean, that's sort of like the general theme of this podcast is, you know, sort of take that as a sign to reevaluate your sleep environment, to reevaluate what's going on, because that could be a sign that like you're not getting enough REM sleep.
Okay, any products or tips for sleeping that we haven't discussed? What about socks?
There's this great paper that was published in Nature a while ago that showed that for like older people that they were sleeping more efficiently if they wore socks. And the theory was that having a temperature gradient between your extremities and your core was somehow sleep promoting, and so having like warm toes helped with that. Actually, what I love about that is that it's just like it's all natural. Everybody has socks. It's like, why not try that?
Sure. So will you sleep with socks on?
I do a lot, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I just find them cozy, though. I don't want to have cold toes.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot. When are we going to be able to see how our sleep is affected by all the different answers, the user input questions on the sleep pillar? Are we ever going to give feedback to people on that?
Yeah, great question. So 2 days ago, there's a big update to the feedback that we give around sleep that went out. And so if you've been answering your sleep surveys, you'll now start to see that the feedback we provide is incorporating that information.
Oh, that's awesome.
And if you're not seeing that, start answering your sleep surveys.
So, for example, you'll tell me like how alcohol affects my sleep.
Yeah.
Sharing my bed,
things
like that. I
learned that when I drink, I get 30% less REM sleep than when I don't.
Wow.
So, and that's typical. So, I mean, we're going to talk obviously about alcohol, which is a big thing that I know a lot of our users are curious about, but also kind of simpler things like sharing a bed and using a screen device.
What does the average Whoop user get for time in bed and hours of sleep?
So the average Whoop user is spending 8 hours and 20 minutes a night in bed, and that's equating to 7 hours and 45 minutes of sleep, which is a sleep efficiency of about 94%. And what's super interesting about that is in 2013, there was a Gallup poll that surveyed sort of Americans in general that found that 40% of Americans were getting less than 7 hours of sleep, and the average American was getting 6.8 hours of sleep. And what was so fascinating about that is they'd actually done a similar study in 1942, and they found that only 11% were getting less than 7 hours of sleep. So there's been a big decline.
So it's getting worse.
It's getting
but
a lot worse.
But Whoop members winning.
But Whoop members are, like, absolutely bucking that
there
trend
we go.
And doing much better. So
and by the way, the lurking variable there may be actually how much more sleep people get once they start using Whoop. Because we've seen this across all kinds of populations. I won't put you on the spot to figure out what the exact numbers are. Oh, you have them. All right. What are the numbers for how much people increase their sleep on Whoop?
So in the first 129 days on Whoop, on average, Whoop users are adding 41 more minutes in bed. So that's like the time that they're dedicating to sleep. So it's equating to slightly less than that of actual sleep. What was the most interesting about that was among those Whoop users who started with fewer than 7.9 hours of sleep. So that was like the lower half at the beginning, those guys added 52 more minutes of sleep. So the worst Whoop users are adding closer to an hour.
Wow. I mean, look, a lot of it just comes back to you manage what you measure. Mm-hmm. If you're measuring sleep, you're going to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in the data.
Yeah, I think that the most like the most exciting thing that we see is that like a lot of times people don't even realize that they're sleep deprived, and so you sort of give them like a bad grade on sleep, and it's the first time anybody's told them that they're not getting enough, and so all of a sudden they're sort of they're given like this new goal as opposed to like, oh, I always get 6 hours, so I'm going to get 6 hours again tonight.
Emily, always a pleasure to work with you in every context, so thank you for coming on.
Thanks.
Many thanks to Emily for coming on the show. She will be back. We learn something every time we talk to her. If you've enjoyed this podcast, make sure to tune in to our Instagram channel this Friday, March 15th. That's at Whoop on Instagram, as Emily does a special Q&A live on World Sleep Day. If you're not already a member, you can join the Whoop community now for as low as $18 a month. We'll provide you with 24/7 access to your biometric data, as well as analytics across strain, sleep, recovery, and more. The membership comes with a free Whoopstrap 2.0. And for listening to this podcast, folks, if you enter the code WILLAHMED, that's WILLAHMED, at checkout, we'll give you $30 off. So thank you for listening. Put $30 on my tab, get that free month, and hopefully you enjoy Whoop. For our European customers, the code is WILLAHMEDEU. Just tack EU on the end of my name, and that'll get you 30 euros off when you join. Check out whoop.com/thelocker for show notes and more, including links to relevant topics from our conversation. You can subscribe, rate, and review the Whoop podcast on iTunes, Google, Spotify, or wherever you've found this podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. You can find me online at Will Ahmed and follow at Whoop on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also email thelocker@whoop.com with any thoughts, ideas, or suggestions. For our current members, we've got a lot of new gear in the Whoop store. I suggest you check that out. It includes 6, 12, and 18-month gift cards, help you save over time. We've got new bands, new colors, new textures. Visit whoop.com for more. Thank you again for listening to the Whoop podcast. We'll see you next week.